Okay, welcome everybody. We are going to talk about the IFRS for SMEs. Michelle, would you like to start?
Okay, well, I plan to start by giving a brief summary of discussions of the meeting of the Advisory Council which took place last week. The staff gave the Advisory Council a brief update on progress on the comprehensive review, and then we asked for their views on three issues. Those were whether to permit use of the IFRS for SMEs by publicly accountable entities, how to address changes to full IFRS during reviews of the IFRS for SMEs, and how frequently should reviews of the standard take place. Essentially, on all the issues, the views of the majority of Advisory Council members are similar to those of the ISV. On issue one, the majority was in favour of keeping the requirement that prevents publicly accountable entities from stating compliance with the IFRS for SMEs. In other words, no change. They generally felt that it was sufficient that jurisdictions could adopt the IFRS for SMEs and call it their local gap and let publicly accountable entities use it, and it was more important to protect the IFRS brand. On issues two and three, the majority thought, although there's a need to find a balance, they felt that perhaps stability of the standard and the need for an independent standalone standard was more important than maintaining alignment with full IFRS. And they generally supported increasing the time between future reviews of the IFRS for SMEs from 3 to 5 years, and noticed this would have the benefit that SMEs can learn from the practical experience of entities applying full IFRS. And there was also some support for having in a mechanism whereby the ISV could move to bring in more quickly any urgent changes to full IFRS, but it was noted that cases like that would be rare. So do any board members have any questions on the meeting, or do any of the board members who attended the meeting as well want to add anything to that?
I'd comment, Michelle. I mean, I totally agree with your summary, and I thought the support on each of those issues was quite strong. It wasn't kind of marginal. There was good discussion on the pros and cons and the other way you could do it. And particularly on that 5-year thing, everybody kind of really thought that 3 years, reviewing every 3 years, was too often, and really focused on the stability angle.
Perhaps we should do that on the big book as well.
Well, somebody in my meeting, and it might have been me, suggested that maybe we should take the SMEs and make it into the big book.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I attended the one of the meeting, and actually meeting itself was really heated than I expected. And I think it is quite important to see the interaction between these three questions. So if we allow public accountable entity to use IFRS SME, so then it should be closely interrelated with the full IFRS, and also it should responsive to the change of IFRS. But if we do not allow public accountable entity to use IFRS SME, then it is like a kind of independent standards, and actually alignment is important. However, we don't need any intensive interaction, frequent change. More stability is important. Having said that, still it's named IFRS SME, so ISV is quite responsible for the such a new independent standard. So that is the important message we received from the Advisory Council.
Any other comments? No? Okay, Michelle, continue.
Okay, so if I move on to Agenda Paper 8A, it's on Section 29, Income Tax. The purpose of bringing Section 29 to this meeting is to get feedback on the process that the staff has gone through when revising Section 29 to align it with IS 12. For example, is there too much, too little detail, and are you happy with the remaining differences between IS 12 and the IFRS for SMEs? However, we're not asking for your approval of the detailed wording in the section today. I don't plan to go through agenda paper 8A, but if any members would like me to clarify any areas, I'm happy to do so. But the question is, do the ISB have any comments or questions on the process followed by the staff in redrafting section 29 as explained in agenda paper 8A?
Patricia?
Michelle, as we discussed, I don't have any problem with the process that you followed. I do question some of, not all of it, but some of the stuff that has been chosen to be left out, because I think most of our constituents would agree that 12 is one of the most difficult standards to understand and apply. And so some of the things that we're leaving out, it seems to me, make it more difficult for a small company to apply rather than easier. For instance, the information on what is tax-based, because in my experience, that's been the most difficult thing for people in many jurisdictions where tax doesn't create a basis in assets and liabilities to really comprehend. So I'm wondering whether we're really helping small enterprises apply this by leaving out that guidance. In this case, more might actually be less burdensome.
Well, we have got away with less guidance in some of the sections because we have got the free training material online. So by putting more simplified requirements in the standard, so that less for them to deal with and provides a bit more flexibility when they're applying the requirements. But then if they do need the more detail, we have got the free training material online that goes into depth in the on the accounting treatment or options that they could use.
Beth?
I just had one. I've just sent you an email with my edits on the paper, but I just had one question or clarification, and that is, I didn't see a requirement to disclose the amount of cash taxes paid or payable in the requirements. Is it there? If not, I just recommend that be a disclosure.
I'll have a look. Then.
Okay.
Legal?
I have one item, you know. The paragraph 11, the A, the next tax credits. And the table say, you know, the big book go out. Hmm. This, but the small book, you know, has this one. I forgot the historical reasons why we did so, and why you recommend to keep the current, you know, requirements like this.
I mean, I'm not quite sure exactly why we haven't got the scope exclusion. I have actually spoken to Mary about this already, and she suggested putting the scope exclusion in as well. Just to make it a little bit clearer.
I made the same suggestion offline to Michelle. Grazie.
Yeah, and I think the reason why we specifically state that there are the difference is that
so the table say there is a big book, scope out that one.
Yeah.
A small book have this requirement. My question is why?
I think it would be clear if we did scope it out, scope government grants out, but that we keep the current treatment we've got for investment tax credits, only because we specifically say that they should be accounted for in Section 29, and whether, I think full IFRS is unclear whether, I think they're scoped out of both IS 12 and IS 20. So you can apply either by analogy with that.
Yeah, my major question is why the big book scoped it out from beginning? And then why it is useful for smaller company to keep it?
Ask the IASC member.
I think it's what Michelle was saying, because the other standards covered it. But because they're excluding one of those standards from the SME guidance, you have to put something somewhere.
Yep.
And they chose to put it here. Is that...
Yeah, that was my understanding as well.
Michelle, just to clarify, my comment was not to change any of the substance, but it seemed helpful to it would be more helpful to an SME user to have an explicit scope exclusion with a cross reference to where else it's dealt with for the grants. Yes. So it wouldn't change anything here. I just thought it was drastic.
Okay, no more comments?
So is the board happy for me to include that in the exposure draft when it comes back for pre-ballot?
Agreed.
Okay, moving on to agenda paper 8B. This paper includes a few additional issues identified by the staff outside the request for information process. The staff thinks these are the last few issues that the ISB need to discuss before the staff can proceed to drafting the exposure draft. I'll go through most of these issues quite quickly, so let me know if you want me to stop and explain anything. The first issue starts at paragraph 4. It's offsetting deferred tax assets and liabilities. The staff have dealt with this issue outside agenda paper 8A because it's not an issue that's arisen as a result of the differences between IS 12 and the 2009 exposure draft. The staff recommend modifying paragraph 29.29 to add an undue cost or effort exemption. An alternative would be to use the IS 12 wording and deal with current and deferred tax separately. However, staff have tried to make the requirements easier to understand and apply by simplifying the wording and keeping the offset requirements for current and deferred tax the same. Does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation?
Yes, we do. There's no disagreement.
The next issue is issue number 2, an exemption for subsidiaries acquired with the intention to sell. Currently, the exemption in paragraph 9.3b is expressed in the singular. Does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 13 and 14 that the exemption should apply to all subsidiaries acquired with the intention of sale or disposal within 1 year? I think Mary had some drafting comments, didn't you?
Agreed.
Yes.
Issue 3 starts with paragraph 15. That's on leases with an interest rate variation clause linked to market interest rates. The staff think under the current requirements, such leases are required to be accounted for at fair value through profit or loss under section 12. Does the IFB agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 19 to include such leases in the scope of section 20 and exclude them therefore from section 12?
And only on the wording, man. They rates or market interest rates, man. But isn't it more that changes in interest rates linked to market interest rates? And I think it is a change of the interest rate in the contract, which is then linked to a benchmark or to a market interest rate. If you read it or market interest rates, it maybe is not so clear. At least
okay.
Not.
With that wording. Suggestion agreed.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, moving on to issue 4, accounting for the liability element of a compound financial instrument. Under the current requirements, if an entity has a compound financial instrument, the liability component is accounted for at amortized cost. Does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 22 to require the liability component to be accounted for consistently with other standalone financial liabilities?
Yes.
No, please, for inconsistency here.
No.
Okay.
Moving on to issue 5 on group share-based payments. I'll deal with part 1 and 2 together as they're addressing the same issue, part 1 and 2 of the questions. Does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 32 and 33 to align the scope of section 26 and the main definitions with IFRS 2 to clarify that section 26 also applies to equity instruments of other group entities?
Disagree, no disagreement. Yes.
And does the IFB agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 35 to clarify that the relief in paragraph 26.17 is for measurement only and not recognition, and also that the share-based payment could be granted by a fellow subsidiary as well as a parent.
Agreed.
Can I just say something, though? In this, I just wanted to caution the answer that you gave to Patricia in the 8A, there is an example that you can go and look at it. You know, one of the biggest selling points that all factor always used to flaunt around for the IFRS SME is that it is only 286 pages or 242 pages or something like that. Okay. Now, by adding all these things, do we think we are making more ourselves more verbose? I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm just trying to see there is a fine balance, and I just feel that we are probably crossing that fine balance. That's all. I'm just cautioning you to just say that, you know, the temptation to put something because somebody asked. I don't know how many SMEs really have stock option plans. Yeah, my experience is that those people who have in the Silicon Valley do not ever try to be SMEs. They want to be another Google or another IBM, so they're not interested in SME accounting. But those who have SME stock option is very finite population, and you're loading up the book. That's all I'm saying. I'm not disagreeing with your accounting.
I think in most of these would just be replacing the requirements or adding a few words. Most of them wouldn't actually increase what we've got at the moment.
I thought it's 26.1A you're going to add. It's a big paragraph you're adding. Adding in
only what's
just telling you that I'm just
a word of caution. Okay, but we agree.
So next issue is issue 6, which starts at paragraph 36. And that's transactions in which the entity cannot identify some or all of the goods or services. Does the EIFB agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 41 to clarify that section 26 should be applied to all share-based payments where the consideration received appears to be less than the fair value of the equity instruments rather than just those required by law?
Yes. Agreed.
And the last issue starts at paragraph 42 on measurement of employee share options. This one's a bit different than the other issues in the paper. In issues 1 to 6, we're more along the lines of clarifying the requirements in the IFRS for SMEs. With issue 7 is a suggestion on how to provide a simplification on measurement of share options, which would be consistent with what we've done for measurement of the entity's own equity instruments in other areas. However, I have chatted to Mary since yesterday, and I'm not so sure that this would actually result in the simplification I was thinking of. Well, we said to allow more flexibility to use other valuation methods of determining fair value, but the staff couldn't really think, because we were thinking more on the lines of intrinsic value, but that wouldn't be a valuation method of fair value. So I don't think that I know another valuation method other than option pricing models of determining the fair value. I'm wondering whether an alternative, whether either the board wants to keep what we've currently got or whether they would consider an alternative of perhaps saying use an option pricing model unless it would result in undue cost or effort and then maybe going down the lines of something like intrinsic value.
It's only a clarification that the option pricing model is one example of valuation, so I don't see a problem.
Yeah. I don't know of any other.
Well, it might have, but, you know, I think this way is clear that they can use an alternative valuation method, so I agree with that.
I think the concern, Mary, I might be repeating what you would have said anyway, is that by using undue cost and effort, you flag when somebody has not been able to use an option method, which you think is the only really valid method out there.
Mm.
If somebody tries to use an estimation method that is not an option value method, it's likely to be a highly speculative method of calculating it, and it's not been flagged as such. So by saying an option method or undue cost and effort means that you flagged immediately the moment you move away from an options valuation method. And I think that was the concern, if I understood correctly, Mary, and I apologize for that.
No, you're misstating it. I had read paragraph 42 and had some concern that the staff was suggesting alternative of intrinsic value as a way of measuring the fair value of a share option, because intrinsic value is not the fair value of a share option. It ignores the time value, which is the, you know, often the primary driver of value of an option.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I got to the words in paragraph 44, the words did not actually offer you any relief from determining the fair value. So the words that were proposed in paragraph 44 did not accomplish what was set out in 42. So I was happy with 44, but then wondered if we accomplished anything. In paragraph, I think there are alternative valuation methods for valuing shares. I didn't have a chance between focusing on this and, you know, after I caught up with you, to look to see if there are other valuation methods for an option. I think anything you do, if you can't get a quote for an option, is an option valuation method, which I guess then raises a different question of, would we want to introduce comparable relief that maybe has been introduced elsewhere in terms of do fair value unless it's undue cost and effort, in which case don't do fair value and say you've used undue cost and effort. You know, if we didn't have a specific request to introduce that, I guess I would hesitate to add in yet another deviation if we haven't had a lot of people saying it's a problem. But I guess you've had mixed informal feedback about that, and I think we probably need, so I'd suggest we either focus on undue cost and effort or not worth making the change in 44, because I think it just adds a few words without giving any relief.
Mm-hmm. What is your real intention in trying to do this?
Well, I was thinking more like giving the entity the option. I think I was thinking more on the lines of if there was undue cost or effort in using an option pricing model of getting something like intrinsic value. But I wasn't, obviously the wording wouldn't get, the current wording that I proposed wouldn't get there.
But I'm with Mary. I think an option pricing model is not any relief from fair value. And if we really want to give relief, then we have to say, because they can use, if there's undue cost and effort, they can use intrinsic value. If they cannot come up with a fair value or really an option price, then maybe as a relief it is intrinsic value. But an option pricing model, and if you explain it, because you should have volatility and interest free and then better and all this kind of stuff, then it's not really a relief or for me. That's what I think.
Could I just come back on that, Martin? I think if we were to do relief, I'm not convinced we should propose something, but if we were, I think I'd rather go with undue cost and effort than saying intrinsic value, because I think you say either you measure it at fair value, you know, which is option pricing, or you explain why you can't,
yeah,
rather than you have another valuation method that somebody has to, I mean, even if you say it's intrinsic value, would everybody understand that that's not fair value, and given how much of an effort it took 10 years ago to do standard setting to get people away from intrinsic value because we felt it was not measuring properly options, I would just really hesitate to open the door to going back to that as, you know, as another method. So I'd say either fair value or nothing, or fair value or undue cost.
I agree, but my point is, but if you want to give, then okay, that they can use intrinsic value. That will not meet that, because I think the
right
option pricing model is intrinsic value is not an option pricing model.
Correct. Yeah.
Right?
Agreed.
Gary,
Michelle, I can support the recommendation here. You know, subject to any improvements in the next few minutes. I actually had a lot of experience in this space in my prior life, where we have subsidiaries run employees that have a piece of any of these phantom shares type things tied to the sub. So I think any relief is appropriate, you know, when you have, when it's basically, our examples were essentially wholly owned with 10% employee phantom shares tied to the unit. It is near, I think it was often near impossible to start getting objective market evidence. So I think the practicability exceptions relief is absolutely appropriate. I do think if we say such as an option pricing model, I think that's going to be the first tool people and their auditors are going to probably look to first. So I don't know if you meant that solely as an example, or is that the first thing to look to after this or not? So that's an observation. And The second thing is, I don't know what the rest of the standard says, but again, always had experience, these models tended to change over time. Do we require it to be consistently applied unless you qualify for market-based evidence? And what is the rest of the standard say on that?
Which one? I mean, when I changed it around, I was thinking other valuation models rather than other valuation models at fair value. I think that's why I came up with intrinsic value, so I think that was just my mistake. But I think the requirements for applying it consistently are, in the standard, are pretty similar to under full IFRM.
Yeah, if they are, that's fine. You don't want people best balling or worst balling the answer, so presumably it's like picking any other accounting principle that's... You do it, and presumably you qualify for objective evidence of general market conditions. But I actually do think if we lead with the example option pricing model, that will be the first tool you're expected to use. And if that's our intention, fine. But if it's truly as an example, I don't think it'll work that way in practice.
Pat?
What would be the requirement if you go down this path, which I support the relief concept, but if you go down this path, what would you disclose in terms of, typically we know what you disclose when you're using Black-Scholes or some kind of binomial lattice approach, but what would you provide in the event that, say, the board of directors came up with their own view? Let's say this was Facebook, okay, and they're using this before they decided to go public and they have 10 shareholders. What would they disclose?
Well, my suggestion, probably as much as I could, if they don't have the, if they have a particular input that was the reason for causing the undue cost or effort, then maybe.
Because when I look at the requirements in the actual Chapter 26, it seems to be kind of light on what you actually do for either shares or share appreciation rights, options, etc. And it seems to make sense that you would give that discretion for a company that's, you know, got a unique business and obviously doesn't have any counterparts in the marketplace, any competitors, etc. But it seems to me this would be one of the most important disclosures actually a company could make.
Mm-hmm. It would probably require some me to go away and think about it.
Okay.
I don't think we should give any relief here. Don't think we should put in undue cost of effort. I think we should leave it at fair value, and if there's going to be a subjective estimate, so be it. I think that's better than not doing anything. I think these companies need to know what they're paying their employees, and I don't think it's right to allow any cost undue effort exception.
Okay.
Exactly the same point that, you know, oftentimes what happens from my experience with these things is that if those standalone SMEs, I don't know SMEs, but those standalone companies which do not have any interest to go public at any point in time, if the employees are given share options, then usually there's a formula to buy back those options. And that's clearly spelt in the documents. So when they say that it will be bought at fair value, then most people use the option pricing model both for the option pricing and for the buyback so that they're consistent both ways. If it is something like a book value times 6 or something like that, then they use another method.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should not go into too much detail here. I think as it stands is good. The only thing is that you have said the input should use market data to the greatest extent possible. This is not a new wording. You moved it from elsewhere in the document to here. And I don't know whether should use looks too strong for me. Because you're saying other valuation models and should use, so you're not giving really the relief. You're taking it from one hand. So that one I would say may use or consider using to the extent possible or some language there. But because the share buybacks have different formulas, one would be book value times 6 or 10. Sometimes it's share options. So you need to incorporate that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't use the word too strongly. Should. But in general, I think leave it as it is.
Mary?
I started out agreeing with PK, but I've ended up disagreeing with him. And I'm more with Stephen. I think we should have a single measurement objective, and that measurement objective is fair value. If we think that people And to Gary's point about in his experience, very often there isn't a market price available. I think if you look at our paragraph, paper paragraph 43, the reproduction of 26.11 highlights kind of the three steps from is there a market price? Well, if there was a market price, it wouldn't be an SME, I think. Down through how you estimate. But if your measurement objective is fair value, then I think the statement that PK was concerned with too strong is a requirement. If you're trying to estimate fair value, I think...
No, I'm trying to say instead of using should, I say consider or increase the market data highest. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I think I get too focused on should, but I agree with the general trend.
But so I think our measurement objective should be a single measurement objective, which is fair value. If our concern is that people need more assistance in understanding what you do if you don't have a market value or you're struggling with option pricing, I think that's the place where we consider educational material for how to do it, not what to do if you can't. And you know, and let's wait for more evidence, if there is any, and the arguments are compelling, that say people need relief from the requirement to measure these at fair value. I'm much more with Stephen in terms of if people are granting these, they should know what they're giving, you know, to people and have to describe how they determined that was the right amount.
But Mary, the only point I want to make here is that people give the stock options, but people also have a buyback programs. And the buyback is a very clear program which says that book value times 6 or EBITDA times, because there is no confusion tomorrow. You can use fair value here, fair value tomorrow. It's very consistently, because if I take the net income for the last 3 years divided by 3 times 6, I get to the number I want to get.
I think that's the kind of thing we can cover in education material about
The reason I'm saying is that using an alternative valuation method, sounds to me that you're giving beyond fair value. Mm-hmm. Then when you come to should, I'm confused. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Darryl? And it's just a little bit on what PK was saying. I think the one thing I would say is that if we don't want to give relief, I don't think we should change anything.
Yeah.
Because I think then we've actually got a paragraph that works, rather than confuse people by switching words around. So I'd be inclined to say, if we're not going to give relief, we give exactly as is. And I think your model where you talk about, I've got a way of specifying, it's not really fair value, it's a calculated value.
Yes.
It doesn't change the fact that you can still fair value the option. Because the option is for an uncertain amount that's calculated in a particular way in the future. So I still think you get to a kind of fair value calculation. It's just, but as you say, that's the thing we can provide guidance on. But just listening to the conversation, I'd be inclined not to change anything, to leave this paragraph exactly as is. Maybe to ask a question about whether, overall, because we are changing a few things in the section, to ask overall whether the share pricing process, the share options process is working, but not actually change something just for editorial change, I think.
There you go.
I'm a little bit nervous about providing the guidance on how to measure fair value. We already made decision. You know, we will not, you know, integrate the team, and we prepare some kind of educational materials already published on website.
Yes.
On how to fair value unquoted equity, and I think before the publications, the board advisor discussed, you know, and the feedback we got was, it is useful, but hard to say whether, to what extent it's useful, because you can integrate so many things you can find in the textbook and all the other kind of publications. And so I'm not sure, you know, what we will promise to provide. Not exactly the Michelle. Is in the plan?
For what we provide in the education material?
Yes.
We have already got section 26 out at the moment. So, I mean, we will update it if we make significant changes to the chapter.
Sorry to butt in, but what Vegu is saying is that those of us who are involved with IFRS 13, educational material, with the equity instruments, unquoted equity instruments, because he and I made a lot of noise on that in the IFRS 9 issue, when we read it, we felt like if I'm not a valuer, I don't get anything out of this.
Hmm.
So what Vegu is appealing to you is that thinking that you will solve this by an educational material to ordinary people like me or Vegu, it ain't going to happen.
Okay.
Because you know the fair value measurement guidance 13 itself is a guidance, and we on top of that we prepare some educational material.
Which is
but we decide not integrate 13, but we promise. Let's assume promise. If you're not able to do, we will give you more guidance through educational material. I really don't know what we can know what we can promise.
Who is in favor of not changing?
That I am.
Three against, so 7, 13.
13.
Okay.
This part of the discussion, yes. Then we continue with IFRIC, I believe. Michael, please.